Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people. And their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine for November 27th, 2013. I'm your host, Dave McLaughlin. Joining me as always, my co-host, Catherine Smith. Welcome, Catherine.
Greetings from Atlanta, everyone.
Yes, and Catherine, as I was planning out this show, or planning who to ask for a guest host, of course, we've been talking about Ted Cruz and other things over and over, and then Time Magazine saw the cover of it, and it says, Texas is America's future. And I thought, we've got to have an expert on Texas, and who better to call on than Jason Stafford. Welcome back to the Kudzu Vine, Jason.
Thank you very much, David. I appreciate it. Thanks, Catherine.
Yeah, well, I mean, we've just been, Catherine can tell you, even we've had on co-hosts from other states, or before it was just Tim, Catherine and I, we kept talking about Texas topics, and then I guess leading it off, Time wrote this article where they fit every state in the nation, a map of it, and made it into the shape of Texas and said the future of America is Texas. Now, of course, the intro lead-in says, you know, some parts of Texas, crime's not doing great. There's a lot of sprawl. Texas doesn't have a lot of social services, but we think this is what the future is going to look like. What did you think of that article? What were your first reactions to it?
Well, down here, we barely acknowledge the rest of the world, and by that I mean the United States. I mean, we think everyone should be paying attention to us all the time, so that's not really newsworthy here for us to do that. But it is, we do think that things are changing rapidly here in a way that they are changing more slowly elsewhere. We were Hispanic before Hispanic was cool down here. And, you know, we have a very young Hispanic population that's getting older. And in the next 20 years, this is going to be the biggest swing state in the country, largely because the Hispanic population is going to become voting age and start voting. So that's, there's a lot of things down here that are really interesting, but it's somewhat due to us, somewhat due to geography and somewhat due to demographics that are, more of a precursor to what's happening in the rest of the country. I think it's pretty exciting.
Yeah, I noticed that Deadspin or Jezebel, one of those sites in the Gawker network, had a graphic of names for boys, and they did girls earlier, from 60 to 2012, and it would show the national and every state. And about 1998, Texas's number one boy name changes to Jose, and it stayed Jose to this day. And I have a funny feeling that, a lot of white and black parents aren't going with Jose. This is Latinos that are choosing Jose, and that's what caused it to be number one.
Very astute analysis there, David. I think that's good. Or should I say David? I think that's good, yeah. I mean, I'm going to change my name from Jason Stanford to Hasson San Fernando just so I can fit in down here now. And, there are a lot of white folks that are just getting really upset about, they think they need to take their country back and restore it to what it used to be. It was never what it used to be. And, even if you do restore the country to what it used to be, you still got to let them vote. And, it's going to be a tough adjustment is what I'm trying to say for a lot of conservative white people down here. And I don't think the nativist impulse of the Republican Party is over by any stretch of the imagination. It's going to be tough for a long time to assimilate.
Yeah, I think Billy Joel had a lyric, the good old days weren't always as good as they seemed, and that seems to fit in what you're saying. But now talking about not just the, the Latino-Hispanic influx into voting, what are some other things from that article that you took that are changing in America that Texas is at the forefront of?
One really bad thing is the increasing dependence on low-wage jobs. We have in the rest of, abroad, by that I mean the rest of the country, a lot of, you know, unions. Union membership is growing here slightly, but the jobs are growing at an even greater rate. In other places where you have better worker protection and better wage controls, better local minimum wages, for example, prevailing wages that are actually enforced, which is a radical idea to us, middle-class people can work and earn a living. Down here, we earn a living. Everyone down here wants to be the rancher. No one wants to be the cowboy, but everyone's the cowboy. You know, the cowboy was an itinerant migrant worker in the early days of Texas. It was a horrible job. Willie Nelson was a workers' rights song, Mama Don't Let Your Babies Grow Up to Be Cowboys. It is a horrible gig. That is the kind of work that keeps getting created down here, but people do it in the hopes that someday they'll be able to own their own ranch and hire other cowboys to do their work. So part of the big problem, again, is the geography. We have a big influx of undocumented workers coming in and suppressing wages for a working man's job down here.
Yes. Well, I could continue to ask questions off of that article, but I want to be fair to Catherine and let her jump in. Catherine?
Well, I found this article quite interesting, actually, just the focus on a number of things, the rise in automation and the gap in skills in the workforce. So how do we how do we escape the country becoming Texas? I mean, I don't mean to criticize Texas, but some of these things are okay, but some of them aren't so good.
Yeah.
And do you think Texas is interested in are there people in Texas who are looking at these, I should say elected officials in Texas and leaders in Texas, looking at these things and saying, wait a second, we really don't want to be the leaders in the rise of the new cowboy. You know, we want to provide better jobs for people, and we want to, educate our young people so that they have a better skill set. Are there people looking at that, do you think?
Yeah, that's a good question. If you ask the Republicans and, you know, the statewide elected officials, Rick Perry, who's leaving, they all think that anytime you bring something like this up, you're running down Texas. You know, they talk about the Texas miracle and all this, how great everything is. And compared to the rest of the country in 2009, it was pretty good. You could find a job, whereas in other
right.
parts of the country, you are SOL. But as things go on, yeah, we are digging ourselves a really deep ditch down here. Poverty is growing. We're going to have this really entrenched underclass. We have the Texas miracle that George W. Bush ran for president on is still not closing the achievement gap. And in fact, a third of every high school class disappears before graduation day. So we've got a third. Imagine a third of Texas without a high school degree, and try to figure out then how we prosper in the future. That is our huge problem. And the dropouts obviously directly correlate to race and income. And we've got poor minority kids who aren't getting educated. So we got, and figure out who speaks for the poor minority kids. We got a bunch of bleeding heart liberals down here who get laughed at. So how do we talk about the future in a way that empowers Texans, that makes them feel like Texans, that speaks to this silly nationalism we feel towards this state, this romantic image we have of, God, by God, we're Texas. How do we talk about succeeding in a way that lifts the lower classes up? Well, that's the challenge of Wendy Davis. And I know we're going to get to the governor's race in a while, but she's playing around with language about how we can do better. She's not falling into running down, saying we're doing so bad, because no one believes we're doing so bad down here. People think we are booming because all you see on the horizon are construction cranes down here. We don't have a foreclosure problem. We've got different problems. We've got investment in the future problems. And the thing that really crystallized this for Texans is when the state legislature couldn't fund the transportation department enough to keep the state highways and the state roads paved, where we have this huge fracking and huge shale boom down here in South Texas and in West Texas. And those big trucks run 70 miles an hour carrying all this stuff everywhere. They're tearing up the roads. well, we don't charge them enough to pay for to repave these roads. So we said,
because they can't afford it, right? Well, they can't afford to pay all those fees.
Yeah, and while they're all getting rich, exactly. And so, but you know, so they said, oh, we don't have enough money. We don't charge them enough money, and obviously, we don't have any taxes down here to pay for these roads to be paved. Let's just let them go to gravel. The idea to Texans that our farm-to-market roads, which made rural Texas economically viable, that we would let them go back to gravel, really hurt us. It really, it was an emotional wound to people that Republicans weren't ready for. So it's finding examples like this that will help Democrats talk about investing in the infrastructure in a way that maybe we can talk about investing in the human resources that will help us get rich in the future, because the only way to do this is to do something about poverty and to get an education system that doesn't sort kids according to who's ready to go to college and who's ready to go to prison.
Right. Well, that's encouraging then. I mean, sometimes it takes a really dramatic turn of events to wake people up. And if it, you know, it might just be that not being able to, you know, keep the roads paved is that trigger for Texas. And, you know, as much of a hardship as that it may be exactly what's needed for people to start listening to people like Wendy Davis and other leaders who may be able to offer some solutions while without being overly critical of whatever success there is, right? I mean, you have to it's a tough balancing act. We all know that in politics is balancing, you know, why I'm a better candidate because I have this vision versus this other person who talks about how great the state is but doesn't have any vision for future betterment, I guess.
Well, what we've been doing for a while is selling the Republicans have been winning their optimistic vision that ignores, you know, they've been raiding the retirement fund basically and saying, hey, look how much cash we have. And everyone goes, wee, cash, this is great. And the Democrats keep talking about, well, look at all the poor people and look at how bad this is. And we haven't figured out down here how to have this optimistic pro-Texas vision of, look what we can do if we fund the, you know, what if everyone got a great education and what if we can keep the roads paved and what if, you know, we weren't having to shut down air conditioning in August because we were running out of power. What if we were better than this? And that's what Wendy Davis is saying. You know, look, we can do better than we are. We can be even like this great vision of Texas. We need to have a competing optimistic narrative that counters their happy horse buggy.
Well, that's great. Thank you.
Jason, I think a lot of times people look at Texas as this monolithic thing where, you know, whatever, if they think the things that, say, Democrats don't like, it a lot of times seems to be, you know, what Dallas and Fort Worth are, whereas some people see things they like about Texas that are Democrats, progressives, and then that's more San Antonio and Austin. I mean, isn't kind of Texas a lot of times in Democratic circles, you think, outside of the state, don't they get oversimplified? And it's really more how Dallas and Fort Worth and maybe to an extent Houston function, and then there's places like Austin and San Antonio.
Well, I don't know. That's a hard one for me to get my head around. There are five big counties. The one that Fort Worth is in is the only real swing county, right? Harris County leans Democratic. It's getting to the point there rapidly where Harris County, and by the way, Harris County has more voters than 22 states. If it were a state, it's big. Dallas County has been Democratic for more than half a decade now, and we have to be very, very careful who we nominate for county offices there. We didn't know it was that close to flipping, and the guy who ran for county judge, which is like mayor of the county executive position. It's not a judge, it's just an executive, was an alarm salesman. We figured, okay, we need some name on the ballot. Let's get this guy. Pulled him out of some Democratic club. Had no business in office. Unfortunately for everyone, he won. And he was a big damn disaster. So, like, when people talk, you know, there's a lot of reasons not to like Dallas. in Austin, you can find a million reasons not to like Dallas. But Jerry Jones gave us a new one today. Thank you very much. But Dallas is a big Democratic stronghold here. They get a lot more votes for Democrats to put in the statewide bucket than Austin does. Austin does okay there. San Antonio with the Castro brothers has become, again, it used to be a swing county. George W. Bush won it. It is now back in our column, despite a lot of Democratic dysfunction down there at the party level. So when people talk, though, from outside Texas about what they don't like about Texas, usually what they're talking about is the Republicans who are in statewide control, who compete to be the biggest loser. Right now we've got four guys running for lieutenant governor, including the lieutenant governor who lost to Ted Cruz in the Senate race. And they're competing against each other over who is the strongest for getting rid of the 17th Amendment to the Constitution right now, which is the direct election of senators. There's no one can really wrap their heads around why this is suddenly important. David Dewhurst, who can really whip a room into a stupor, he is so boring. He is trying to liven up his image a bit, and so he recently came out for impeaching Obama. He didn't really say why. He wasn't asked to because he said it in front of a Tea Party rally, and people said, well, finally he gets it. Of course we need to impeach Obama. At least when Democrats were really mad at George W. Bush, we had specific reasons. He misled the country into this horrible war with thousands of people dying and trillions of dollars lost. I mean, there was real reason, consequences and actions. They are just sort of vague about it down here. It's just sort of an article of faith with everyone. Also, the State Board of Education, where they're trying to, take out things like facts from textbooks. That's also very controversial. So I think it's less, David, to your point, I think it's less of a geographical criticism of Texas and more of an overall arching absurdity narrative of stupid that we project to the rest of the world.
And okay, well, let's continue on Texas topics, and let's talk about the guy who is definitely in charge of the Texas Republicans, and some say in charge of Republicans, nationwide. You were talking about, the Hispanic growth in Texas. Man, y'all are recruiting Texans from Canada. Ted Cruz.
Yes.
Let's first talk about Ted Cruz. Give us an insider's view from in the state. I mean, has this guy risen so fast among the right in his party?
Well, no one believed me, but in a lot of ways, Rick Perry was a moderate. He did the little dance for crazy people, but he told everyone in the legislature to not even bring out anti-immigration bills from committee. He said, don't even do it. You're going to make us look bad. I will kill you if you do it. And everyone behaved for a long time. He would put idiots in charge of the State Board of Education, but he wouldn't really go to war over their stupid ideas. He'd let the fights play out. He threw the rights for a long time. He didn't push anti-immigration stuff. He barely moved the needle on choice. He focused relentlessly on privatization and on his vision of job creation, which is handing corporations millions and millions of tax dollars. So he wasn't really a social ideologue. And there was a lot of pent-up frustration for a long, long time. Like, they wanted power. There were a whole bunch of ambitious people down here. And the right was just made to compromise constantly on the things they thought were the most important, except for gays. Rick Perry loves beating up on gays. Draw the conclusions as you may. So Ted Cruz comes along, and David Dewhurst was from that. He was brought up in that Rick Perry school of, okay, we're going to throw the right a bone, but we're going to run things the way we kind of want to run things. And everyone, he was from the I'm in charge, everyone follow along thing. Except no one was ever scared of David Dewhurst. And this Ted Cruz guy comes along, and this is the first time national money played in a primary in Texas. This is the first time the right wing had a charismatic guy who didn't look like Louis Gohmert. And then, he just starts talking to people. Oh, finally, this is the idiot we've been looking for all along. And he has this way of talking where he is trying to, he's the subtext of every single thing Ted Cruz says is, of course I'm right. You, of course, realize I'm right. And when you disagree with me, you're realizing by consequence that you are wrong. And that feeds into the self-satisfied idiocy of the right about how they're obviously right about everything. They don't need to explain anything, so stop bothering me about facts. And it just he was like the crack they didn't know they were looking to get high on. And it just made them feel so good. So now there's this army, and they're Ted Cruz's army, and it's the Republican Party. And no one can command them anymore. Rick Perry turns around and is like, damn, what happened to my people? And they're gone. David Dewhurst, the guy that beat him, has just lost his manhood. He's doing whatever he can to try to get on with the right. It just, oh, it's beautiful. So all of these guys are terrified of getting Ted Cruz, you know. And we talked about the lieutenant governor's primary down here. These guys are writing Ted Cruz's name on their peachy every day. You know, it's always Mrs. Ted Cruz. That's what everyone wants on their ballot line. That's all anyone wants to be known as down here. Yeah, the only gay marriage Republicans are for are them marrying Ted Cruz. That's it.
Well,
so, yeah,
I can continue.
He's got everyone terrified down here.
Yes, I can continue to ask Cruz questions, but I'm going to let Catherine go ahead and take some. Catherine?
Well, I don't even know where to begin with this guy. I mean, I'm just, like, so aggravated by his...
Isn't it interesting, Catherine? Like, we never Mike Lee could talk for an hour, and we'd go to sleep after 15 minutes, wouldn't we? Ted Cruz talks, and I want to punch him.
Yeah, and I like the way you describe this, you know, knowingly this arrogance that he has, which is the same arrogance that's very prevalent on talk on right wing talk radio. This idea that,
mm-hmm.
of course, we're right, and any idiot who doesn't agree with us is wrong and an idiot. And
right.
when I used to listen to right wing radio a lot more than I do now. I've given it up, pretty much.
Good.
But
good.
When I do, I
that
get
sugar,
so
right?
aggravated because of that attitude that. Oh, you know, everyone knows that we're right, and they're lying. I mean, they're like they say something, and then they say, "Of course we're right." And you listen to them, and it's especially if it's anything about the Affordable Care Act, forget it. But anyway,
right.
Ted Cruz, I'm kind of curious about does he have like how do he and Rick Perry get along?
No.
How does the Republican Party like, is he sort of the de facto head of the party now? And
well, okay, this
like,
is
how
an
does,
interesting...
How is the party interacting with Ted Cruz?
This is an interesting thing. He is ahead of the voters now. The Republican primary voters, unquestionably, he is the most popular guy. The apparatus is still kind of beholden to Rick Perry, and is now working for Greg Abbott, the attorney general, who actually was Ted Cruz's mentor. So there's this new faction of the Republican Party that is going to make us miss Rick Perry. When I wrote a book about Rick Perry called Adios Mofo, Why Rick Perry Will Make Us Miss George W. Bush. We're actually going to look back at George W. Bush as the good old days. That's how bad Greg Abbott is. Greg Abbott is... he's the attorney general down here. He's in a wheelchair, which is almost, with one exception, irrelevant to the whole discussion. He sued, and he gets several million dollars a year from his annuity, which he deserves, but he's also for tort reform. Ted Cruz was his solicitor general, and Ted Cruz argued all these cases against the Obama administration for Greg Abbott. So those guys are peas in a pod. Greg Abbott described his job as getting up and going into work, suing Obama, and then going home. Republicans absolutely love him for this. They don't care that he is letting big business run roughshod over everything. He went to West, you know, where they had that big factory explosion. He went there to comfort the afflicted, but never actually to demand answers or justice. So, I mean, if you're a big, you know, big business, very wealthy Republican guy, Greg Abbott's your best friend. He is an incredibly partisan attorney general down here. He makes no bones about being partisan as an attorney general. He, you know, there's no pretense of doing the people's work or government being nonpartisan. He is a partisan government official. And it's not really all that a controversial notion down here. That is Ted Cruz's mentor. So there's this new faction that's coming up into leadership, and Ted Cruz, in fact, is already there. But a senator in Texas is a senator for life unless you really embarrass us. Or, you know, if you, like John Cornyn, if he just sits there and doesn't do anything, he can be a senator for as long as he lives. We don't care. It doesn't matter. Mostly this applies to congressmen as well. A governor, that's the man. So Greg Abbott is, he will control the local apparatus. He'll control the state party. Ted Cruz is going to control the national party.
I see. Okay. Well, and
yes.
Also, okay, go ahead. I'm sorry, David.
No, go ahead, Catherine. If you got
no,
go
I was
ahead.
I was gonna move on to Greg Abbott if you want to.
Well, let's stay in the Cruz family. I mean, since we're all under
okay,
one
go
roof
ahead.
With the Cruzes, let's talk about Heidi Cruz. The New York Times did a piece on her saying that she lives in a way that makes her the kind of person the Tea Party or hate. She's
mm-hmm.
a vegetarian. You know, she's a Wall Street banker. I don't know what
yep.
much more about Heidi Cruz, but apparently she backs her husband's policies but lives in a different way than the average, you know, Walmart voter maybe.
Well, David,
you know
I guarantee
Texas-
you. No one knows anything about her. And, in fact, I think most people would be a little freaked out that she's white. But I know for sure that if you ask a Tea Party person what they'd be most upset about is not that she works for Goldman Sachs, but that she's a vegetarian.
Yes.
They consider that is a big deal down here. What I, you know, from what I know, and I know people that work who worked with her, she is in private finance, in the management of rich people's money. You know, she's not an investment banker. She's not all about screwing up the world. So to the extent that facts matter here, she's not part of the problem. She's helping rich guys get richer, but not on the global scale that ruined our economy. But, yes, she does work for Goldman Sachs, and those are two hot buttons. But, no, that's a big insider deal down here. I mean, and for people who know Ted Cruz, no one – we give him credit for being a sociopath who actually believes what he's saying. But everyone who's an insider down here remembers when he didn't believe what he is saying now. For example, when George W. Bush ran for president, Ted Cruz helped him come up with his pro-immigration plan. After he left Greg Abbott's office, one of his clients was a teachers union, and he argued for better teacher pensions in this lawsuit. So, you know, his opinion seems to depend on whatever suits his needs at the time. And it's not really shocking anyone down here who's paying attention to the New York Times that, you know, his wife is works for Goldman Sachs. In fact, there's a long tradition of Texas political wives holding diametrically opposed views from their husbands in a way that humanizes them for people who believe the earth is spherical in nature. Rick Perry's wife, Laura Perry, she's pro-choice. In fact, it recently the governor's office had to walk back some comments where she said abortion is a woman's right. Laura Bush, pro-gay rights, pro-reading, which has become a radical thing, pro-choice. Yeah, I mean, this weekend is the Texas Book Festival, which Laura Bush started because she's got a master's in library science, and she was the liberal Democrats really liked Laura Bush, and so we don't really think it's a weird thing if the wives don't agree with the husbands. Because, I mean, God, look at the husbands. Why wouldn't the wives disagree with them? We all kind of give them a pass on that one.
Yeah, and I think it's funny that you said people would be shocked to know that a lady named Heidi was white. I thought when you – that was pretty much a given that all Heidis were white, but
Who
knows?
I mean, Ted Cruz having a white wife, the biracial marriage is the thing that might ruffle a few feathers down here.
Okay. Well, you know, we're talking about women and Texas and disagreeing. Before we get to that governor's race, since, you know, being able to register to vote will get you there, there's a bill before, run around Texas saying that you have to have the name that was officially your name, maybe that's on your birth certificate, to be able to vote. And if this were law, were enacted and followed to the letter of the law, it would disenfranchise somewhere around 20% of all women
Shed some light on this thing.
Well, the good news is that in Texas, hardly anyone votes. So to the extent that it's going to disenfranchise people, it'll largely disenfranchise non-voters. So most people won't notice this down here. But this is voter ID. You guys, I think, have a voter ID bill or law there in Georgia.
Yeah, we have for a long time.
Exactly. They did this. Many people, you know, Republicans elsewhere have admitted this is to, you know, keep Democrats from voting. I think we all saw the Daily Show last week where the guy in North Carolina said, oh, yeah, black people and college students, they're not going to vote. But the bill, the law says that your photo ID, and there's very tightly prescribed lists of voter of photo ID, has to match exactly what your voter information is. For example, my voter information is Jason A. Stanford. My name on my license is Jason Andrew Stanford. They said, you got to sign this piece of paper saying you're the same guy and they'll let you vote. Two-thirds of Texas women are in that boat, right? Either their maiden name, you know, they have a driver's license with their voter information, their voter registration. Most women have registered to vote when they weren't married. Then they got married, and so their license has the new name but not their voter information. And so most times, I mean, with very, very few exceptions, I think, they'll be able to sign a piece of paper that says, you know, that they're the same, you know, that Catherine Smith is Catherine Jones, because there will be other identifying marks there, like same birthday on the thing, whatnot. About a third, though, a third of Texas women don't have that state ID. They don't have a driver's license. They don't have a state ID card. They don't have a hunting license, which is one of the forms of acceptable ID, although a college student's ID is not. That's a problem. You know, there are a lot of women out there who are old enough where they just kind of don't drive anymore. Either they are elderly and live in a nursing home, or they just, you know, people drive for them. They just don't need a license anymore. So they don't have the photo ID. So they've got to go to the police and, you know, the state patrol and get a new ID card. And to do that, and this is what you were reading, to do that they need to bring their birth certificate or a marriage license or something like that. There are some women in Texas who are so old, their Social Security cards are still made out of metal. So if they still have one of these ancient pieces of ID that maybe have their two or three married names ago or something like that, and then they got to go get their marriage license from, could be another state, who knows? I mean, this is a bureaucratic nightmare for a lot of people in a state where people don't bother to vote anyway. So the most
I just want to interrupt here for 1 second.
Vote. Yeah,
I want to interrupt here for 1 second because we have the same situation in Georgia, and by and large, these elderly women have been voting probably in the same voting location.
Yes.
And oftentimes on a very regular basis, they're, you know, the elderly are very good voters generally, and especially elderly women. So they have been voting in the same location.
And their
without
neighbors
any ID.
Are the people at the precinct. They know the
people
at the precinct.
And the people at the precinct know
name.
Them. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's the part that really just, you know, really grates me is that here, so these, I mean, we're talking about elderly women that may never leave these retirement homes. In fact, some of them, their voting precinct is actually in the retirement home or in the, you know, community center right next door. And they never leave those locations for any reason. That everything they need is there. Their families come and visit them there. Their groceries are delivered there, or they eat their meals there. And now they're being forced to go out into the world to prove that they are themselves, even though they've been voting for 20 years in that same location. And that's the thing that just is so it's so insulting and degrading to these elderly, not just women, but like you say, it does mostly affect women. It's ridiculous.
Right. There are a lot of – the reason the Republicans push this is because they know Hispanic people disproportionately lack the state ID and that they're probably not going to go into the state patrol office and say, hey, give me an ID, especially black people. I mean, for a while, they were looking up your warrants before they were giving you an ID, before some Democratic lawmakers raised hell about this. So people were staying away in droves. In fact, since they passed this law, only 41 people have gone into the state offices to get an ID card. So people are not doing this so far. This is an unintended benefit for Republicans, is that this is hurting women. I mean, they did this to hurt Hispanics, blacks, and college kids. They didn't know they were also going to get women in the bargain. I really don't think they had thought this through. They're acting a bit surprised about it, frankly, right now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's obviously just another, you know, instance where the Republicans are trying to suppress the vote, and I don't even realize that. I don't even know sometimes if they realize the impact it will have. Like, so many times it affects, like Catherine was saying, elderly people, and elderly people are, by and large, white elderly people are pretty reliable Republican voters more and more so now, particularly in the South, and they're being disenfranchised along with maybe a lot of the targets, and that's what's so silly about all this kind of things. Well, Well, let's move on to the governor's race. Catherine was trying to get us there, and let's get there before going longer. And, of course, we can talk about the Democratic candidate, Wendy Davis, but I know you have a article coming out that's going to come out nationally tomorrow. If you preview it, it's on Greg Abbott, and we assume will become the Republican nominee.
Yeah, Greg Abbott, he's the guy we talked about. He's running for governor, the attorney general is. The odds-on favorite to be the Republican nominee. He's running against Wendy Davis, a woman so popular. And David, you pointed this out offline, that you think that there's a character on Scandal who's modeled after her. And I don't disagree with you. I think that's a possibility. Someone just this white hot out of nowhere politician, you know, good looking gal with long blonde hair, played by Lisa Kudrow on the show, could be played by Wendy Davis. Absolutely same thing. And so popular that they made a joke about her on How I Met Your Mother three weeks ago, when the brunette from Canada looked at another woman in a bar who was wearing running shoes and says, what's she going to do, filibuster later? We've never seen anything like this down here. So everyone's talking overtly that if Wendy Davis gets white suburban women to vote for her, she can win. Everyone's done the numbers and went, oh, crap, this could actually happen. It's a long shot, but it could actually happen. Greg Abbott's figuring out what he needs to do is campaign for the women's vote, make sure that they don't go to the woman. And so he's campaigning around this week saying, and here's the direct quote, I'm proud to say there is nobody in the state of Texas who has done more to fight to help women than I have in the past decade. Now, he makes some good points about prosecuting sex traffickers and collecting $27 billion in child support. These things are also his job, but God bless him. His campaign is doing a different thing. This is a case where his right hand doesn't know what his far right hand is doing. His campaign was collecting petitions, you know, put up some big picture up there saying Wendy Davis wants to bring gun control to Texas. That in and of itself was a lie. Wendy Davis, in fact, voted to give Greg Abbott more power to stop local gun control. So it's the opposite of what he said, and that maybe that we should just agree that everything we hear from Republicans these days, take the opposite. And if the opposite's true, well, that's good enough. We'll just go with that. So they lied about that, but that really became less important because soon thousands, and it came more than 3,000 people put comments on this Facebook posting. A few of them were death threats. Those were taken down by the campaign because those are, for one, they're felonies. You cannot violently threaten a public official in Texas. But it's amazing what he left up. It is this ending stream of vile sexism left up on Greg Abbott's Facebook page about Wendy Davis. I looked on it as long as I could stand it, and here's some things that are still up on that Facebook post. One person said, she looks like a throw rug. I'm not really sure what that means. I'm not really sure what this means either. Someone else called her a whiny, panty wagon broad. Catherine, how do you wag a panty? This has been really bothering.
I wondered
like,
about
do you take
that
it off? Yeah, is it like you're shaking your butt and you're wagging it that way, or do you take it off and wave it around? But that would be panty waving. I'm really bothered by the semantics of this. It's been, for about almost a week, it's been throwing me. Those were almost the nicest ones. Someone said piss on her. Another one said someone needs to flush her where she belongs. And then there was, you know, the usual litany of socialism, go back to California. And then there were a lot of real obscenities left up on his Facebook page. So you can't, on the one hand, say you're the world's greatest defender of women and then also give sexism such a big forum like that. It's just, it's really awful how Republicans in the state are responding to Wendy Davis and attacking her in terms that you can only use toward a woman or, admittedly, a cross-dressing man.
That's crazy to think about, that someone would just post all this on a Facebook page. And, you know, we've all worked in campaigns. You work deeply in campaigns. You have to clean this stuff up if you really care, if you think it's going to hurt you. And maybe Greg Abbott doesn't think this kind of language is really going to hurt him.
No, it's pretty clear that his strategy is to get the Republican base out. I think, you know, he thinks that if he just gets a big Republican turnout, then he'll win. And there is a lot of merit to that. You don't win off your elections in Texas, which are really low turnout elections, by going after the middle vote. There is no swing vote. There's the conservative vote, and then there's the tiny Democratic vote, and you're trying to get the weak the soft Republicans, who are the ones up for grabs, to turn over and get for you. And right now, soft Republicans are trending toward us really fast. For the first time since Ann Richards, white suburban women are more likely to identify with the Democratic Party than the Republican Party. And this is largely a function of how turned off they are to the Republican Party. So Greg Abbott's playing a dangerous game here. He's doing things and giving a forum to attitudes and voices that are alienating a really important part of his voting bloc. But by doing that, he's also energizing the core Republican vote, which is angry white men. If he can he wants to recreate 2010, and if he can do that, he can be the governor of Texas. If white suburban women hear what's going on here, though, and if Wendy Davis can coalesce them, then she can be the governor of Texas. So he's trying to do one thing and not pay the price for it. So it's going to be a tough thing.
Yes. Well, Catherine, I know you were trying to move to the governor's race. I'll let you ask your questions about either of the candidates.
Well, it seems like we've covered a lot of it, but is there even going to be a discussion of issues in this race, or is it really just going to be, you know, Wendy Davis, the, you know, devil incarnate, and Greg Abbott, the fool?
That's a good question. I don't know. I mean, I think there's eventually going to have to be a debate, but these two personalities are so well known. I mean, there are four really well-known politicians in Texas: Rick Perry, Ted Cruz, Greg Abbott, and Wendy Davis now. And people are going to have their minds made up about them. So I don't know that actually discussing the issues is going to matter all that much. I mean, Wendy Davis is going to have to push her moderate image in a way that might break through and not get defined as Eric Erickson from Red State said, abortion Barbie, even though her stance on abortion is much more moderate than Greg Abbott's stance. Greg Abbott actually isn't even for exceptions for rape and incest, and he's pretty squishy on the life of the mother. When pressed, he says he wants to save both their lives, it's like, great.
Well, everybody wants to save both of their lives, of course. I mean, that's like...
And
obviously,
I want everyone to have green apple Jolly Ranchers, but sometimes you've got to make a choice, and that's the point of the exception list, isn't it?
Yes.
You know, it's the hypothetical specificity of it all. So, yeah. God, Catherine, you just depressed the heck out of me. I mean, are we ever going to actually talk about what's going on? I don't know. I really, really don't know. I mean,
I'm sure that
I think
there will be people that try. I mean, I'm sure that, you know, some of your news people and some of your, you know, various organizations that have that issue oriented will try. But
you know how it works. You know how it works. I mean, the press and these people can all ask and they can get an answer, but does it start a real discussion like the abortion Barbie insult or these death threats and, you know, these types of things? These are when you get real people talking about it, then something's happening. But if you're just having the Dallas Morning News ask Wendy Davis what her position on fracking is, then that's not really going to be a discussion of the issues that you were talking about. I think maybe we have a chance to do that with education, which Texans are increasingly not seeing through a partisan lens. The issue of testing that I'm really heavily involved in has totally wiped out the partisan divide on education. People now approach it as an issue and not as a political issue. So maybe they'll get into a discussion about education that could engage people and start a real discussion about what the future of Texas is. That might work. There's no
sounds like infrastructure might be something that
infrastructure might be it, but then that gets to money and then that falls into the partisan traps. Healthcare, there is no hope of talking about healthcare probably for the next 5 years without it being really about a talk about the black president.
Now, do you have your own healthcare, or are you using the national?
We have the best healthcare system in the world. Haven't you asked for Perry?
But do you have your own exchange?
No.
Okay.
We took a lot of money to set one up, and we never did it. But Rick Perry has said everyone can just go to the emergency room, so he really doesn't see what the problem is. We turned down more than $100 billion to expand Medicaid, or was it Medicare or Medicaid? I don't know. Whichever
Medicaid.
The one they wanted to. Thank
the Medicaid expansion, yeah. We turned it down, too.
Yeah, just intentional, willful stupidity really should be a Texas motto. That's, you know,
lots
instead of drive-friendly. Yeah, jobs.
Lots of jobs,
like,
lots of money, lots of, you know, healthy people. But,
yeah
we did it too.
Your tax dollars will work, but they won't think. So that's the problem.
Well, no, your tax dollars, those tax dollars that you paid in for Medicaid, they're going to, you know, the states like Ohio and Florida and the states that did expand their Medicaid. That's the thing. I think that's the best argument that, you know, some of the Tea Party or – you know, some of the, you know, conservative people would accept as like, okay, we've already paid, the money's there.
Catherine,
some of it came
using
from
logic.
Us.
You're
I know.
Using facts and logic.
I know.
This is the trap we fall into. We listen to them, and I heard you saying this earlier, oh, but what they're saying isn't true.
I know. Yeah, it doesn't matter.
Yeah. Getting mad about intellectual inconsistency and illogical fallacies has got to be something we train ourselves out of. We just need to beat them. Just say things that people agree with and just beat them, because trying to make sense of things isn't working.
Yeah, but, you know, it's hard for us liberals to be like that.
Yes, I know. It really, really is.
That's really
The good news about sending our dollars to Florida and Ohio and those places is they're swing states. So the more money they get for this, the better they're going to feel towards Obama, and they're going to feel grateful, and they're going to vote Democratic and, you know, into the future. And eventually we'll get this sorted out, because Republicans will, you know, starve nationally. It'll be great. They'll be, you know, we'll vote for food will be their motto.
David?
Well, before we go any further, and I know we've spent a ton of time on Texas for you, so this may end up being our last Texas topic. Houston has a pretty competitive mayoral race. Jason, give us a synopsis of that thing.
It's a much, much more competitive race than people thought. Anise Parker's very strong politically with her base. She seemed to be doing a good job. Haven't been any huge controversies. About the only thing that might motivate her base is that she is an out lesbian. And it might sound strange to outsiders that Houston elected a lesbian, but they knowingly did, and they seem fine with it. But there's a wealthy African-American conservative businessman who decided to run against her. I worked for a wealthy liberal African-American who ran against her the first time, and he lost. He could not bridge the black vote to the Tea Party vote. That was the tough thing for him. This guy, Ben Hall, who's running against Anise Parker, has no problem with that. He's already a Tea Party kind of guy, and he might be able to do a lot better than people are expecting. People thought initially that he wasn't going to, no matter how much money he spent, he wasn't going to be able to provide a real good opposition. But I'm hearing rumbles from Houston that the polling is not as good as anyone expected it to be, and they're looking at a runoff. But we'll see, you know. No one's expecting her to lose because she has the real infrastructure. But I saw that Ben Hall has asked me. He's got, you know, Communication Workers of America. Those people in a street fight in a real low turnout election might be able to turn out the vote. So there's a possible upset brewing in Houston. I think we're just looking at a closer election than we expected, though.
Yeah, well, it'll be one to watch because obviously on the election day this year, you know, other than the Virginia governor's race, there's just not as many big-time races. You know, New Jersey not being much to look at. Well, and we'll see because I know that's one of the places where if Democrats are going to build the bench, if you will, the
mm-hmm.
Houston mayoral race is one place to do it from because Bill White was a credible candidate. He was just, I guess, too soon maybe.
Bill Clinton couldn't have won in 2010. It was a bad, bad year. So I he was the wrong candidate for the wrong time. I think Bill White in a different Bill White would have won in 2006 in Texas. 2010 was a horrible time, horrible time. Now we're optimistic again, so we'll see.
Yeah. Well, let's kind of move out of Texas, but Jason, we're going to keep you with us and let you talk about other things. Now, Jason, we know that straw polls don't really mean anything, but they're just too interesting to talk about, in particular when they come from the largest Republican or the largest county of Republican voters in Georgia, Gwinnett. And, Catherine, Paul Brown won this thing, and won this thing, you know, by 3 or 4 points. Karen Handel got close. Catherine, I'm going to come to you. Is this a pretty good sign that Paul Brown has a chance to at least push this thing to a runoff?
Well, you know, I don't know about straw polls, but I got to tell you, these numbers scared me. I didn't really think that it would be, you know, Paul Brown, Karen Handel. I thought it would be, you know, maybe Paul Brown, Jack Kingston. But Jack Kingston came in a pretty distant third. I mean.
Yeah, because he's from some part of Georgia that doesn't even count. It's close to the ocean and all. It's
well,
not north suburban Atlanta. And I'll tell you, I think Karen Handel would be a much tougher candidate for Michelle Nunn to beat. Paul Brown is one of her best chances.
It's going to be hard. It's going to be hard for Michelle Nunn to the way things are going, it's going to be hard for her to distinguish herself from Karen Handel.
Yeah, politics
isn't Paul Brown. Isn't Paul Brown the Louis Gohmert with a medical degree?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes,
I like him.
The flat earther that somehow went to medical school.
Where do I send
school?
Him money? Oh, I love that guy. Yeah, isn't he the guy that said climate change is a lie from the pit of hell?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, Jason, this is our I'm trying to think of all the guys. Todd Akin, the guy from Indiana, Murdoch, I believe it was.
Richard Murdoch.
This is the guy that will stick his foot in his mouth repeatedly. Phil Gingrich's good at it, too, but you see
and Phil Gingrich's also
pretending.
A doctor.
Yeah, he's pretending. Paul Brown is the genuine article. He believes all this crazy. It's a real debate among us at times. Are we fearful that the craziest guy will actually win the Senate race and we'll have to have him as a senator? But at the same time, we really know he's our best chance to beat him. So what do we want? Do we want the best Republican in case they win and they have to be our senator, or do we want the one we can beat? And we always have that debate.
No.
Now, Jason, you be an opposition researcher. What's your take on it?
You want the one you can beat. I love that. I mean, for one thing, Michelle Nunn, she's going to draw national eyeballs. She's going to strike a lot of people as a responsible person. So she doesn't have to build herself up like, say, a Jason Stanford for Senate would have to. You know, that's Sam Nunn's kid. She's probably good. So that's good. She's got that going for her. You're right. I mean, Catherine, I think you're right. Handel, that's a tough – there's no contrast there. Gingrich, he acts stupid, but everyone can tell he's pretending, so that's a problem. You need the guy you can beat. And God forbid he gets in there. None of these guys are going to do anything anyway. They're all going to vote the same, right? No one's going to be allowed to deviate from the party line. You want the one who's going to embarrass the soft Republicans.
And so they go, oh, God, I can't. Oh, I must have been drunk. Oh, Jesus, this is awful. That's what a lot of people right now in Texas are feeling about Ted Cruz going, oh, dear God, we thought he was just pretending. He had a Harvard law degree. We thought he was smart. So anything that hastens the transformation, I think, is a good thing. You all in Georgia are a lot closer than we are in Texas. So I think, you know, either you win or you win by losing.
Yeah, well, it's good advice that we have a lot of listeners that I think have the same debate we have, because I'm always kind of on your side. Jason and our former co-host Tim always was worried that we would actually have to, you know, live under these people's.
Yeah, that's my always
well,
my
understood.
Worry.
I guess you are always the swing vote at times, Catherine, on those debates.
No, I'm afraid of Senator Paul Brown. I would be, you know, I'm rooting for the best candidate, not the one we can beat. I mean, I want to beat them, whoever they are, but it scares me to think that Paul Brown could become a U.S. senator.
Catherine,
yeah,
see, most
one
of them
other...
scare me.
Yeah. Yeah, well, listen,
there's
let's
one other point
we'll,
in Paul Brown's favor, entertainment value.
Well,
Bill Gingrich
is
not going to make you laugh. You're going to go, oh, God, here he is again. Paul Brown's going to make you go, oh, cool.
Oh, I don't. I think Phil Gingrich is just as scary as Paul Brown, really. I mean, the one that I think is the most palatable, and I say this, I mean, David knows, what I'm like as much of a Democrat as you can be, is Jack Kingston, because at least he has some experience in and he can speak in a complete sentence.
Oh, that doesn't go well.
Yeah.
No, they can't do that.
And I'll tell you what, I secretly believe that Karen Handel is a closet moderate that hasn't been exposed yet. I'd love to see her get exposed because, of course, it should be DOA, you know, in the Republican primary. But I really think she's more moderate than the persona she's created, particularly since she lost the governor's primary. But we shall see what happens with that. Jason, about 3 minutes, the number one race between now and the next 10 days is the Virginia governor's race. Give us your take on it.
I think Terry McAuliffe's winning in a walk. I think a lot of the bad press he's getting right now is the stories that were all set up for when this race got competitive and the press was going to see what Terry McAuliffe could do and they were going to, you know, try to take him down. Now they know it's, you know, empty the notebook time. And I don't think there's a better example of that than this story of how he bought into some annuities for where specific people would die, and then he would profit from that. That's unseemly, and it's gross, but it's completely legal, and it goes on all the time. A lot of, you know, it happened in the 80s, in the AIDS crisis. The gay people would be dying, and rich people would buy the life insurance from, you know, being the beneficiary and then give these dying people money for their health care. Right? It's just, it's gross, but it's a legal way of making money. It certainly doesn't disqualify him from being governor. I mean, heck, it's an innovative way of making money. So I really think there's a lot of little sniping right now. It reminds me a lot of the stories about raising money from Chinese people in 1996 for Bill Clinton. It was a really boring last 2 weeks, so the press had to think of something to do to keep people interested. Yeah, this race is not competitive right now.
Yeah, how much of that do you think was a drag that E.W. Jackson created, or was Cuccinelli going there anyway?
I think it was Ted Cruz. I think this race was probably going to be a little close, but there are too many sane Republicans in Virginia. A lot of them work for the government, way disproportionate from the rest of the country. And when they shut down the government, Ted Cruz became the big hero to the right. So Cuccinelli had to choose between all of these voters in Northern Virginia who are mad at the Republican Party and the people and the Republican base vote that loved Ted Cruz. And Cooch went in with the Ted Cruz people, and he alienated the Republicans who didn't have jobs anymore, temporarily. That's when this race just got wiped off the board. I think the Jackson thing was kind of funny, but that's, you know, the lieutenant governor doesn't do anything down there. I don't think it mattered that much.
Yeah. Well, Jason, thanks again for being on the Kudzu Vine and informing us of all the happenings about Texas.
Oh, it was my pleasure. I loved it. Thanks a lot. Good talking to you, Catherine.
Thank you.
Good evening, everybody.
You're well.
Good evening.
Bye-bye.
Good night.
We are the heirs of that.